It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Almost a century ago, in a vast expanse of Central Africa known as the Belgian Congo, King Albert I of Belgium decreed the continent's first national park to protect key habitat for our biggest and most impressive relative, the mountain gorilla. The park still survives. Today, it's known as Virunga National Park, in what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC. But a series of wars and rebellions since independence in 1960 have killed more than 5 million people, and protecting almost everything there has been a challenge. There are still mountain gorillas, but they are in deep trouble. Reporter Karen Lowe recently traveled to Virunga, where one of the park rangers, Innocent Mbromwe, led her deep into the forest in search of gorillas.
I can't say it's because I love them. Every time when I'm with these animals, I feel very good to be with these gorillas because they are like human.
Here's Karen's report.
When trekking through Virunga National Park, your senses are always on overdrive. You don't want to miss anything. Virunga has rainforests and volcanoes. Its savanna wildlife rivals the Serengeti. The source of the Nile is here. It has the largest lava lake on Earth and glaciers. There are at least 1,000 species of animals, including some odd ones, like the okapi. It looks like a cross between a zebra and a giraffe. Or the recently discovered Lesula monkey with a human-looking professorial face. But the marquee draw, the reason most people come, is the mountain gorilla, the world's largest primate. This species is on the critically endangered list. There are only 880 in the world, and a quarter of them live here.
Are you ready? So can I put the mask?
Right now, I'm following Innocent Mbromwe. We're looking for one gorilla in particular, Humba, a silverback with about 20 family members. Innocent's a 38-year-old ranger and an expert on mountain gorillas. He runs the park's southern sector. We're flanked by two other rangers with machetes and AK-47s, just in case we encounter hostile rebels and charcoal traders.
Every time we have to be together.
Nearly 150 park rangers have been killed since this country descended into war almost 20 years ago. Just before I arrived, one ranger was killed and two were injured. The gorillas are deep in the forest, and to get to them, you have to hack your way in. Vegetation is so thick that visibility is only a few feet. But honestly, at the moment, I'm not really concerned with gorillas or even armed rebels. I'm worried about the giant Congo spiders with 6-foot leg spans. I carefully place my foot exactly where Innocent has just lifted his. But vines wrap around my ankles, and I become a sweaty mess trying to keep up with Innocent.
Come on.
He patiently waits for me to pull myself together. He's cool. Not even a crease in his uniform. Innocent is formal in the field, but when he sits and talks about his relationship with the gorillas, he softens.
I can't say it's because I love them. Every time when I'm with these animals, I feel very good to be with these gorillas because they are like human.
He also offers some tips on gorilla etiquette.
Before reaching the gorilla, you have just to give the signs. Means you was just understanding what I was doing. Just to communicate with gorilla so that it can just remember that this guy is my friend. It's not the enemy. There is different signs, but some signs is just showing that we are friends. But the other ones, it's just telling to the gorilla, please don't approach me. Yes, for example, this one. And another one, it's I'm not the enemy, but I can just want to play, but not play. Even in the family, they communicate each other by signs.
Innocent spent years learning how to communicate with the gorillas and getting Humba acclimated to humans. Sometimes it got dicey.
At the beginning, it was very, very aggressive. You know that it's a wild one. So coming every day, trying to give signs, And you'll see that the silverback is coming, is charging, is crying. Then every individual is beating his chest, is coming toward you. Then you say, oh my God, what I'm going to do? Now he's changing. Now he's very quiet, very calm.
As we move through the rainforest, looking for signs of Humba, Innocent occasionally grunts to announce our presence. He points at some flattened branches. That's where Humba's family slept overnight.
It's an adult female which passed the night here because the hair is not whitish. It's black.
We walk on, and he plucks some gorilla fur from a branch and shows it to me. Then he points down. No explanation needed. Gorilla dung. Then we come to one of Humba's sentinels.
It's not the chief of the family, but it's one of their members. It's Nyakamwe.
They greet each other with the formality of two generals. Standing about 10 feet apart, they grunt and acknowledge one another respectfully. Innocent negotiates our passage. The gorilla turns and leads us to his family. We adjust our face masks that we were given to make sure we don't spread any diseases to the gorillas. As we get closer to Humba's troop, a few gorillas beat their chest. They're showing off for the tourists. And then there's Humba. He makes me feel very, very small. Mountain gorillas can weigh nearly 500 pounds. Their outstretched arms can measure 7 feet across, and a full-grown male can be 10 times stronger than a man. Humba is completely unfazed by us. He sits on the ground with his back to us and pulls down branches the size of saplings to eat the leaves. At one point, Humba lies on his back and crosses one knee over the other, arms behind his head. Total alpha pose. Humba's troop and Innocent clearly are at ease with each other. Humba's name means peaceful. Rather than face a fight with another silverback, he'd rather move his brood a safe distance away. I feel safe and move closer to the gorillas, which annoys Innocent a bit. He spotted some blood on leaves, which means there's been some fighting before we came. There are two silverbacks in the group, possibly trouble there. There are about 2 dozen females, though you don't see them all at once. But everywhere you turn, if you look closely into the brush, you will see eyes peering back at you. I cough a few times, and each time I do, one of the gorillas does too. They're mimicking me. Juveniles roll around and play a ball of fur and feet. A baby grabs for my camera, but Innocent gently shoos them away with branches. Then Humba walks in my direction. I hold my breath as the giant silverback moves past me just a few yards away. You can see the power ripple across his back and shoulders. After about an hour, Innocent tells us we have to leave. As I walk away, I look back at gorillas peacefully eating and playing, and I wonder, can this last? They face a lot of problems. Potentially the biggest one isn't even visible yet. The Congolese government granted a London-based oil company rights to explore for oil in an area that would cover about half of the park. The oil company, called SOCO, is finishing seismic testing in a nearby lake. It's uncertain what will happen once they're done. I want to talk to the park warden about this. So the next day, I walk over to Makeno Lodge at Virunga Park headquarters. The director is Emmanuel Demerode. He's a primatologist by training and a Belgian prince by birth, though he never mentions that. He's dressed in a green uniform with a rolled-up beret pinned to his shoulder. On the day we talk, he's optimistic about turning the park into an economic engine. He says tourism and agricultural projects like coffee and cocoa plantations could generate as many as 40,000 jobs. They're also building hydroelectric power plants that could generate enough electricity to cover park expenses for the next 80 to 100 years. Demerode says if oil's to come, there needs to be enforceable regulations and resources in place because of the potential risks.
The risks, of course, are to do with an accident. There isn't a single oil field on Earth where there hasn't been an accident. So to say that there won't be an accident in Congo is ambitious, I'd say. The other issue, of course, is all the spin-off effects of an activity like that that need to be managed very, very carefully. Economic thinking, they talk about le mal hollandais, the Dutch disease. And it's a term that's used for when you have a region like this and suddenly a massive influx of activity t- tied to a single industry, which is oil. It kills off a lot of the other activities around it because it just swamps it.
And then there are the direct threats inside the park to the gorillas. He recalled the night in July 2007, before he became a park warden, when he and Innocent heard gunshots in the bush.
So the next morning we went out and walked through the rain for several hours and eventually came upon a terrible scene, which was the massacre of the Rugendo group of gorillas. And basically we found four bodies of the mountain gorillas that had been killed. The fifth one was found several days later. They'd all been shot at very short, close range. One of them had been shot and then doused in petrol and set alight. So it was a very brutal, very vicious killing.
Demerode says the massacre was the work of charcoal traders. They'd been cutting down trees for fuel at an alarming rate. The Congo's charcoal trade is worth millions. That's a lot of money here, where the average annual income is $120 a year. And the militias are getting a cut. Park rangers were getting in the way of business.
And the rangers really are on the front line trying to prevent the forests from being destroyed, in particular the gorillas' habitat. So by killing all the gorillas, these militias were betting on the fact that it would discourage the rangers and stop them from protecting the forest so that they could access it and make money. It was a very, very violent scene. It's extremely brutal. And for Innocent, it was all the more terrible because that was his lifetime's work, and it was also his father's lifetime's work. His father died protecting those gorillas.
At the time of the massacre, Demerode was working with a conservation group, and Innocent was leading the rangers. Corrupt officials were blaming Innocent for the attack.
And he actually went to prison for it. There were trumped-up charges. Essentially, they accused him of resisting arrest, and they tried to turn things against him and tried to blame him for the killing of the gorillas, of negligence, of not protecting them adequately and so on. And then he was just arrested and quite badly beaten when he was in prison. We were able to get him out after a few days, and eventually we were able to demand an inquiry into the whole thing, and the real people responsible were eventually arrested.
After that incident, the Congolese government wanted someone who was not caught up in local rivalries to run the park. That meant bringing in an outsider. They offered it to Emmanuel. That was an interesting choice, given that Belgium ruthlessly exploited the Congo when it was a colony. Emmanuel became the only foreign national to have judicial powers in the Congo. His first mission was to find out what was happening with the guerrillas. But rebel fighting made it too dangerous to go in. Ultimately, he brokered a deal with all the warring parties to let the rangers back into the guerrilla sector.
Been away for a very long time because of the war. We crossed the front line and went up into the hills and into the forest, right up into the mountains, and finally saw the Humba group, who we hadn't seen for 15 months. And they immediately went to him. So Humba himself, the silverback, immediately went right up to Innocent, walking past me and the others and straight up to him. And so there's no doubt in my mind that he has a very unique relationship with the gorillas.
That kind of relationship between the rangers and the gorillas is key for tourism. And if Emmanuel just had to contend with poachers and rebels, his 700 rangers might be able to hold the line. But the prospects for oil in the DRC have dramatically ratcheted up tensions over the past few years. In addition to the shootings, there have been recent death threats against conservation activists. Emmanuel and his rangers took huge personal risks. Innocent has not only buried his father and his brother, but now one of his sons has told him that he too wants to be a ranger. Asked if it's worth it, Emmanuel is unequivocal.
That's not a question you can ask yourself. If you start to ask yourself that question, then it becomes, you know, an impossible situation. You know, we have to do our job. It's just the decision we made when we decided to become rangers.
When we walk back down the mountain, out of the park, we stop at the ranger's post. It's hard not to notice the spent rocket and mortar shells heaped in a pile on the ground from past combat over the Congo's riches. One of the great potential casualties in that conflict is the robust biodiversity of Virunga National Park, and that includes the mountain gorillas. From the Democratic Republic of Congo, I'm Karen Lowe.
Karen's trip to Virunga National Park was supported by the International Women in Media Foundation. And she's on the line with us now. Karen, it sounds like things are pretty tense on the ground there in the Democratic Republic of Congo. What exactly is going on?
Right now, there is a sense of euphoria among the park rangers and conservationists because Soko Oil has agreed to suspend exploring in the Virunga National Park, or any UNESCO World Heritage Site around the globe. It's a victory for conservationists, a big one, at least for now. But Soko will finish what it set out to do, seismic testing for oil on Lake Edward. It's one of East Africa's Great Lakes, and it supports about 80,000 people. What this agreement means is after the seismic testing is done, any actual drilling must be done with UNESCO's blessing. But this victory came at great cost. And we have to remember Soko's activities have only been suspended. We still don't know how things will play out in the long run. And the DRC government still hasn't said what it will do.
Now, what about the conservationists? What kind of concessions have they made and how did things change so quickly?
As part of the deal, the World Wildlife Fund, which lobbied mightily against Soko, has agreed to drop its demand for a probe of Soko. The oil company is publicly traded, and the WWF had alleged Soko had breached global corporate responsibility standards. It took a long time to get to this point, and there's been a lot of violence over the park. But the thing that probably forced Soko's hand was the shooting of park director Emmanuel Demarode.
What, he got shot?
Yeah, he was hit four times as he was driving through the park, and he was only 500 meters from a military post. He's okay now. He was treated in Nairobi, and he's back in the park. But Soko has condemned the shooting and denied any responsibility for it. Demarode was shot just a few hours after he had delivered to the Congolese prosecutor the results of a three-year investigation. That probe was approved by the Congolese court in 2010. The document contained allegations of intimidation and bribery carried out by those who wanted to open the park to oil exploration and drilling. The investigation is a separate matter from the World Wildlife Fund allegations, so all of this doesn't just go away.
What are some of the specific allegations that were in the report delivered by Demarode to the prosecutor?
Basically, that elements of the Congolese government and military who favored drilling allegedly used bribery, torture, and death threats against activists and park staff. Those threats go back for years and had been getting progressively more violent. The report also says that park authorities found that a Soko oil representative paid a senior park official several $1,000s to support Soko activities. And then that park official later threatened to fire rangers who didn't go along with the oil development plan. There were also instances of torture. There were some pretty horrific elements, too. When the head of the park's central sector resisted pressure to open up the park to oil interests, he and his brother were badly tortured. Then their captors paraded the park official through his neighborhood and snuffed out burning cigarettes on his head, a not-too-subtle message to others.
What role did international attention play?
There was tremendous international pressure applied. The showdown got widespread media coverage, especially after a movie, Virunga, was released. The producers managed to catch on tape some of the shady dealings. And recently, Human Rights Watch called on Belgium to investigate the attack on Demarode, who is one of its own nationals. The Human Rights Group also asked the UK to investigate, under the UK Bribery Act, whether any of the alleged acts of corruption and bribery might have led to attacks on rangers and activists. If there are violations, Soko and its officials could face criminal prosecution.
It seems pretty clear that someone wanted Demarode dead. Who do you think?
Yeah, there are a number of parties aside from Soko who wanted oil drilling to happen, including elements of the military and rebel groups. They always profit from resource extraction in the Congo, and they're not so worried about what's legal. So they might have just seen Demarode as someone who's getting in the way of business.
So what does Demarode do now?
For Demarode, Virunga National Park is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and he's determined to protect it. He's driven by what he sees as a perfectly achievable ambition— get the park functioning as a tourism and agricultural enterprise, and a lot more people will benefit from that than they will from oil. And he's got proof right next door. Rwanda endured a horrific genocide 15 years ago, and it's pretty much recovered. And a big part of its economy is tourism. It makes about $430 million a year, mostly from tourists who want to see gorillas. So Demarode figures the DRC can do this too, especially since Virunga has more natural attractions.
So what kind of help is he getting pushing ahead with this?
For one thing, the philanthropist Howard Buffett is a huge supporter. He's an avid environmentalist, and he's also the son of multi-billionaire Warren Buffett. He's poured $20 million into hiring park rangers and getting the lodge ready for luxury tourism, and he's also developing hydroelectric power. The idea there is that if people get electricity, they'll be less likely to burn down the forest for charcoal. When I asked Howard Buffett how long he can keep supporting Dumerode's efforts, here's what he told me.
This is one of those things where there is no second chance. There is no, well, if it doesn't work, we'll go to plan B. There is no plan B. So you can't let them do this.
One last question, Karen. How's Humba doing?
Oh, Humba, he suffered a setback. The other silverback in his group challenged his dominance. And as we know, Humba doesn't like to fight, so that must have been hard on him. Somehow he's making do with six of the troop's 16 females, though.
That's Karen Lowe, just back from the DRC with the tale of its guerrillas, the people trying to look after them, and the threats still facing them. Coming up, lessons from the African savannah. That's ahead here on Living on Earth. Stay tuned.